Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. Coming up today, we're going to look at the rise of the far right, the armed far right in the U.S. There are increasing indications that some people are preparing for armed conflict in the U.S., and we're going to talk about that over the next hour here on Radioactivity. And we are in a fun drive, so we're going to thank some people that called in to From a Woman's Point of View, and Arlene is back. And Arlene, I know you've got somebody you want to thank.
Hi, yes. It's another member of that great anonymous family, but we want to say a big thank you for a $50 pledge. And the person also wanted to say a shout-out to Miss Julie. So thank you ever so much, and keep the donations coming now for Radioactivity, and keep your dial tuned to WMNF. Thank you very much for everyone that called in during the last hour.
All right, that was great. So Sean Cadan is on the phone with us. We're going to just take a short few minutes and just thank the people that have called in previously for Democracy Now! Democracy Now!, by the way, did reach its goal. We got 22 people to call in. Sean, how are you?
I'm doing great. It's super to hear that Democracy Now! Has support, and we're looking now for support for Radioactivity, and I can't wait to hear the people that Rob is going to thank in just a second, but before he does that, I'm going to give out the telephone number so that you can call in and show your support for Rob's great interview show, Radioactivity. That number is 813-238-8001. You can donate online at WMNF.org as well.
Sean, here are the people that called in during the last few minutes of Radioactivity. During the last few minutes of Democracy Now!, Sister Kelly called in from Tampa, made a $100 contribution. We'll send you that WMNF t-shirt, Sister Kelly. Thank you. And thanks to Anonymous, who's in Tampa, who made a $40 contribution. And this is from Doris Smith. Thank you, Doris. Thanks to Kathleen Griewatz from Tampa. Made a $15 a month contribution, taking the WMNF Emergency Weather Radio. Thank you very much, Kathleen, for that $15 a month contribution. And her favorite shows are Democracy Now! And Dr. Fred Harvey. That's great. Thanks to Anonymous, a $20 contribution, likes Richard Wolf and Amy Goodman. And Anonymous, thank you. Thanks to Anonymous in Clearwater, who made a donation of $5 a month, joining our circle of friends, and likes Democracy Now! Jill in Dunedin, thank you for your $10 contribution, loves Amy Goodman and Talking Animals, says keep up the great broadcasting. Cheryl Hapke from St. Petersburg has made a donation of $100. She's taking a WMNF t-shirt, and she loves Democracy Now! And the unbiased real news. And Martha McAndrew from St. Petersburg, thank you very much. 813-239-9663 is our phone number. Paco Amran made a $60 contribution. Thank you, Paco. He says, I listen when I can for reporting that challenges situations and presents opposing views, allowing their representatives to present their opposing views meaningfully. Thank you very much for that. Kathleen Spearings from St. Petersburg made a $10 a month donation. She's joining our circle of friends, which is our sustaining membership, and she's keeping programs like Democracy Now! On the air. Anonymous has made a $500 contribution. Wow, that's great. Thank you, Anonymous, for that $500 contribution. And again, our phone number is 813-238-8001. Thanks to Anonymous in West Palm Beach, just made a $10 a month contribution. Thank you, Anonymous. Kevin Marshall from Venice has made a nice contribution. Thank you, Kevin, for that nice contribution. And Robert Gelson from Winter Haven made a $100 contribution. Thank you. Celeste Almarico from Tampa. Celeste, thank you. A $30 contribution. Anonymous in Odessa has just made a $100 contribution. And here's a $5 donation from Tampa. Thank you, Anonymous, for that $5 contribution. Well, we're getting a lot of good donations for Democracy Now! During Radioactivity today, we'd like to hear from 20 people. And if we do, we'll be on target. So please go to your phone right now and call us at 813-238-8001.
That's the number to call in. And we bring you all this news and information programming every weekday morning during our news and public affairs block from 9 in the morning until 1 in the afternoon. And whether it's Mark Bureau's show, talk show, or news from Dr. Richard Wolf, Economic Update or Alternative Radio, all of these great programs, the Women's Show, all of these are terrific programs that we bring you, but there is a cost associated with that. We are paying for the electricity at the station. We're paying for the great equipment that we have, and it takes our listeners to pay for that radio bill. And the way that you can contribute is by calling 813-238-8001. Be part of the big community. We all come together to pay for the radio station and to keep it up. And you can join at as little as $5 a month or $10 a month and sustain this radio station through the Circle of Friends. You can also donate at WMNF.org.
All right. Well, Sean, we're looking for our first donation for Radioactivity. We're going to hear an interview with Robert Evans, who's an investigative reporter. He writes for Bellingcat. He's on the west coast of the U.S., and he's based in Portland, Oregon, although he's covered wars around the world. And he's been covering far-right activities on the west coast, especially in Portland. And this is an interview that we aired last week. We're going to play it again because so many people were talking about it. And Evans got the secret communications of some far-right groups, including the Patriots Coalition in Portland, and found that they were planning violence. And we're going to hear about this next. We're talking about groups that believe in armed conflict. In Michigan the other day, 13 people were arrested for plotting to, among other things, kidnap the governor of Michigan and also attack the state capitol in Lansing and try to start some sort of armed conflict. And they wanted to put the governor of Michigan on trial. So there are groups around the country, not just in Portland, but all over the country that are contemplating armed violence in the U.S. And we're going to talk about that in a serious way today. And if you appreciate the fact that WMNF devotes time to this, please call us at 813-238-8001. Some people are warning about a civil war. I think it's fair to say that most of the people with weapons are on the right. The left doesn't usually use weapons at all. So let's listen to this interview with Robert Evans about what he learned about the far-right organizing and plotting for violence on the west coast of the U.S. Robert Evans, thanks for coming on WMNF. First of all, let me ask you about Portland in this past weekend. Did anything happen of major significance in Portland this past weekend?
There was a small rally yesterday. It was a pro-Second Amendment demonstration at the site where a member of Patriot Prayer, which is kind of a local right-wing street movement, was shot during an altercation several weeks back. So there was a rally yesterday. I think about 20 or so people showed up for the pro-Second Amendment side, a decent number of them open carrying. There was a counter-protest from left-wing protesters. It was fairly uneventful. There were a couple of deployments of mace and some hucked water bottles, but nobody got really hurt. Nothing really very significant happened. It was kind of definitely sort of a low ebb and a return to kind of the normal sort of dueling demonstrations that Portland had over the last couple of years, as opposed to the hyper-violent ones, like the one that we had on the 22nd of August, which was a real nightmare in terms of, like, the amount of force that was went out between both sides.
Are the protests continuing outside the federal building in Portland?
Not on a regular basis. There are protests still continuing. So the protests were starting with the beginning sort of George Floyd's death and the start of protests nationwide. Portland protested every night for more than 100 nights. And then the entire state of Oregon sort of caught on fire. And that kind of, you know, the protesters suspended protests and set up instead a bunch of mutual aid coalitions to, like, provide supplies to people who'd lost their homes and people who were sort of having to evacuate. So basically everybody turned out to help the community during that period, and the protests were paused. And the fires are gone now, but things have kind of continued at a lower ebb. There have been protests, but not every night. People are being a little bit more, I would say, cautious about, like, when and how they do it, as opposed to kind of feeling like they have to protest every single night in order to keep the streak alive, which was sort of something we were seeing for a while. Things have been on a bit of a lower ebb. But, you know, when protests turn out, they're still getting very good numbers. It's not at all uncommon for 500 to 1,000 people to show up for a march.
Yeah, it's pretty big. If I were to use the TV ads by Republicans as a way to gauge how bad things are in Portland, your city's on fire, and I wouldn't want to set foot in it just watching the ads from the Republicans on TV.
If you were to set foot in Portland right now, unless you went out of your way to come across a demonstration or happen to be located next to one of the pieces of police property where they sometimes occur, the only signs you would see that anything's been going on is perhaps some graffiti. The protests in Portland, we had one night that was a real, what I would describe as like a real riot, where just a bunch of people are breaking into businesses and stuff. And that was back on the 29th of May. Since then, looting's been very rare that a business has been broken into, and virtually all protest activity has been focused on police buildings and infrastructure. So building, the various police precincts, the ICE building, the federal courthouse, the Justice Center, which is our local police headquarters. And those are, you know, individual buildings within a fairly large, sprawling city. The vast majority of Portlanders have seen no signs of anything happening other than, you know, graffiti. And there have been a number of, like, protests that didn't march on police property, right? People have gathered in parks and stuff with Black Lives Matter signs. That happens pretty regularly. But, no, the city is not burning. City infrastructure has not been harmed. The majority of businesses outside of, you know, the ones that are not able to do what they do because of COVID remain, you know, open and functioning. Like where I live, the part of town I live, there have been no protests, and you wouldn't know that, like, Portland has become the center of a great deal of national discussion over political violence because it's perfectly quiet out here.
All right, so if I wanted to go to Powell's Books, or if I wanted to go to one of the Asian restaurants along the train line in downtown, or if I wanted to go to the art museum, no trouble. I mean, I could just get around everywhere and do everything I want to do as a tourist in Portland.
Yeah, with the exception of the fact that we're in a pandemic and a number of those places are not, you know, functioning at their normal capacity as a result of state rules about the pandemic. But yeah, you wouldn't run into any issues as a result of the protest. The protests are not going after art museums or Asian restaurants or anything like that. Powell's Books. In fact, I can remember during the big riot night, there was a moment where someone was attempting, like, going up to the Powell's Books as if he was going to break the window, and other people in the crowd were like, no, no, not that one. Go after the banks and the Gucci stores. Don't hurt the bookstore. Which, you know, you can have whatever opinion about you want, but Powell's, yeah, I think, is more or less okay, outside of the fact that it's, you can't really shop inside it the way you used to because there's a plague.
Yeah. Our guest is Robert Evans. He writes for Bellingcat.com, and this is WMNF in Tampa. So I called you up because you wrote this fascinating article a few weeks ago, headlined Patriot Coalition, Leaked Messages Show Far-Right Groups Plan for Portland Violence. And then you go on to say that Bellingcat, your publication, has acquired several months of chat logs from the Patriot Coalition of Oregon, a network of pro-Trump, pro-police activists. These chat logs were provided by an infiltrator affiliated with the anti-fascist collective, the Eugene Antifa. What did you find out when you got inside the chat logs of the Patriot Coalition?
I mean, a tremendous amount of very disturbing things. There was a lot of talk among members of doing night raids, of going out and abducting activists during protests at the night, during the night. There was even talk about targeted assassinations, both of people within sort of the left-wing protest community and within sort of Oregon politics. So there were discussions of, you know, potentially bringing harm to the governor or to the mayor of Portland. There was a lot of talk about preparing for a gunfight with left-wing protesters as if there was going to be an opportunity to shoot it out in the streets. And there was even some talk about sort of wanting that and hoping that that would happen. And there was a lot of discussion about what kind of illegal weapons, you know, activists could get away with bringing because they felt that the police would not stop them from using illegal weapons like batons and stuff against left-wing activists, whereas, you know, they thought the police would come down on anti-fascists more strongly. And it was very disturbing. I would actually say it kind of had it felt reading through this, and, you know, I've reported on a number of actual war zones. It felt reading through this like a proto-insurgent movement, right? Like they hadn't taken that step, obviously, but they were talking about those sort of things. So it was very unsettling. And when we reported on it, it was taken very seriously by law enforcement at a number of levels and by the state government. Our governor declared a state of emergency before the protest, that preparing for this big Proud Boy rally on the 26th, because this group, Patriot Coalition, was pretty closely tied to the Proud Boys. They had a lot of communications with them. And there, as a result, kind of that rally Number one, the governor threatened to use, Oregon has anti-paramilitary laws. So in the state of Oregon, particularly if you travel to Oregon from elsewhere, having trained with a group of people to do violence, it's a serious crime. And it is also in Florida, as a matter of fact. And in fact, Florida's anti-paramilitary laws are somewhat stricter than Oregon's. So the governor's kind of made a threat that, hey, if people come into Oregon to do violence here, they will be very, very harshly penalized. And that Proud Boy rally was kind of ringed in by police. Of Proud Boys were criminally cited for, and other attendees of the rally were criminally cited for possession of firearms that were not legal for them to be carrying in the way they were carrying them, and possession of other weapons. A lot of people had paintball guns loaded up with rubber-coated metal balls, which they were shooting during that big street fight on the 26th, just kind of blindly into crowds of protesters. There's a number of very large lawsuits, including like a $1.2 million lawsuit against the Proud Boys right now from that rally on the 22nd. So Patriot Coalition, it was sort of a catch-all organization for folks that weren't affiliated with Proud Boys or Patriot Prayer, but were very closely tied with them and wanted to take action in the street against them, and felt that as a result of how intense the protests had gotten, or at least their perception of how intense the protests had gotten, a much higher level of violence was from them in order to crush the protest. Yeah, in a nutshell, kind of what was going on.
I found it interesting, too, though, some of the discussion in those chat logs was if you were to freeze paintballs, they could become lethal or cause a lot of damage. So you could bring the paintball gun in, and the cops would think, oh, it's just a paintball. But if you use, you said that they actually used metal bearings in the
rubber-coated metal. That's one of the ones they talked about. And yeah, they froze paintballs and they shot them at people. I know people who were hit in the face and pretty badly hurt. You know, the rally on the 22nd. So what happened on August 22nd was a large group of Proud Boys with kind of members of different militia organizations and groups like Patriot Prayer all showed up downtown, 300 or so of them, for a Back the Blue rally. Now, and this came the 2 weekends prior to the 22nd. There had also been right-wing rallies in the same location in front of the Justice Center downtown, and both of them had involved gunfire. The week before it had involved gunfire, and there was then gunfire again on the 22nd from right-wing demonstrators. And basically what happened is these 300 or so folks, like, gathered together with a bunch of shields and weapons and paintball guns. And initially, the counter-demonstrators were very outnumbered, and there were a lot of really ugly assaults. People, like three and four folks, just beating somebody on the ground. I had my hand broken because I was filming a group of these Proud Boys and other group guys sort of beating people, and broke my hand. And then when I confronted him about it and told him that I was pressed and unarmed, he slammed me with his shield in two or three times. And there were a lot of really ugly assaults, a lot of mace deployed, a lot of rubber paintballs and frozen paintballs being fired at both press, legal observers, all sorts of folks. And then, Portland has a very active, obviously, left-wing protest community, and people have a good system of kind of bringing folks in during emergencies. So while this fight was going on over a couple of hours, the number of left-wing counter-demonstrators grew and grew until there were way over 1,000 of them. And at that point, both sides clashed in like a full sort of like two shield walls going at each other. And the right-wing demonstrators eventually broke and retreated, largely because they had all brought mace and had been firing mace into the crowd. And when you have enough people shooting mace, it becomes impossible to continue to stand in an area unless you're wearing a high-grade gas mask. And the left-wing protesters all had very good gas masks because they've been getting gassed by the police for 100 or 80-some days prior to this point. And the right-wing demonstrators didn't have gas masks. And so they were eventually, from the sheer mass of mace deployed, unable to stand in the area, and they left. So that's kind of an overview of the 22nd. It was a wild thing to see. And I think kind of within the state government, that helped, that along with the article about what was going on with Patriot Coalition, kind of helped to galvanize will against some of these right-wing demonstrations. There have been some very ugly ones over the last few years and some really ugly fights between right and left-wing demonstrators, including an assault by members of Patriot Prayer, which is one of our local right-wing groups, on a cider bar that was frequented by anti-fascist activists, where one of them hit a young woman from behind and broke her neck with a baton. So there's been a lot of really ugly fights and kind of minimal. The kind of attitude that the local law enforcement in particular had to these was, these are all mutual combats, right? So we're not going to get involved if two groups of people just decide they want to fight it out in the streets, which is a peculiar thing to hear from law enforcement. And I think after the 22nd, there were just so many injuries and what was happening, because there were no police in sight whatsoever during this gigantic street fight that eventually involved more than 1,000 people. They just didn't intervene. And I think there are now enough voices in city government that are like, you can't just let this happen. This is wild. Like, we can't have 1,000 people beating each other half to death in the street, because one group of folks wants to rally with weapons and start hitting people. That's not okay. And I hope that we're past the days where that's going to be allowed to happen.
Our guest is Robert Evans, and he writes for Bellingcat.com. He's based in Portland, Oregon, and this is WMNF in Tampa. You infiltrated this the chat room that was operated by this right-wing group, the Patriot Coalition. You found out that they were planning to infiltrate the left-wing group. Talk about that for a moment.
Well, yeah, you know, it's not wildly difficult to quote-unquote infiltrate. And you'll see a bunch of people. This is always something to be kind of hesitant about. When you hear somebody saying they've infiltrated Antifa, all you have to do is wear a black hoodie and a face mask and stand in the middle of a group of other people doing the same, and you can say, I've infiltrated Antifa. The reality, of course, is that most, like, Antifa or anti-fascism is a collection of tactics that groups of people, many of whom don't know each other and were not previously affiliated, can use. There are some individual anti-fascist groups that are actual organizations. Eugene Antifa would be one. And they're the folks who infiltrated Patriot Coalition and actually handed us those chat logs, which brings me to kind of an important point that I think is often lost in the media, where when people talk, you know, when the media tends to talk about Antifa or anti-fascist, they all tend to be thinking about these kind of black-clad anarchist kids who mask their faces and break windows and stuff, and that certainly is a chunk of people who engage in those tactics, for sure. But the vast majority of anti-fascist work, and I've communicated with and have contacts in a number of these organizations, the vast majority of what they do is online research, is studying what particularly, like, members of neo-Nazi groups and other racist groups are doing, of infiltrating their organizations, and you know, the kind of information they get out from doing that has proven incredibly useful to state and federal law enforcement in the past. It's cited regularly in charging documents. It's very useful to journalists, and it's again much more. And from my vantage point, from what I've seen, both participating in a huge number of street protests and reporting on the growing insurgent right-wing movement in the United States for years, and sometimes consulting law enforcement for it, is that the vast majority of what quote-unquote Antifa groups do is this sort of research, is this kind of infiltration stuff. You know, I think that there's certainly criticisms to be made about a lot of things that happen in the streets, always. But when it comes to the actual quality of the research a lot of these groups do, it's really, in many cases, kind of beyond reproach. I've seen a lot of very important work done. And, you know, the first really influential piece of writing that I had come out about this right-wing insurgent movement happened after the Christchurch shooting, because I had been studying 8chan for years, this weird little online hole that the Christchurch shooter announced his rampage in. And the question that I kept getting from the media over and over again was, how do we find these guys before they act? What do we do to actually locate these people before they get a chance to kill? And the answer is what a lot of these, what groups like Eugene Antifa do, is you infiltrate these organizations, you read their communications, and you try to identify which members are making explicit threats, which members are, like, traveling to sort of attend events and network with other members, which of them have weaponry, because those are all kind of signs that someone is going to engage in a terrorist attack.
That's Robert Evans, who's an investigative reporter in Portland, and he obtained leaked chat logs showing Portland-area pro-Trump activists and far right-wing activists were planning and training for violence, sourcing arms and ammunition, even suggesting political assassinations ahead of a series of rallies that took place in the last few months in Portland. And we're going to hear more of this interview in just a moment. We're fundraising here at WMNF, hoping that you will call us up and keep this voice of freedom and free speech on the air and make a contribution so we can continue doing programs like this. Please call us at 813-238-8001 and tell the people answering the phones here at WMNF you want to make maybe a $100 contribution, maybe a $25 contribution, but your money goes to operating the transmitter and all the equipment here at WMNF and allowing us to do programs like the one you're listening to right now. Our goal for the next 2 hours or hour and a half now, our goal is to hear from 40 people. And so far, we've heard from four people during radioactivity so far. We have a challenge, too, and that is that if we can get 10 people in the next half hour donating $100, we'll get an extra $1,000 from two generous donors out there. So let's hope that we can get that $1,000 challenge match from two generous donors. We've had two calls in the last few minutes. Paolo Albuquerque and Doris Nerito, together from Largo, made a $100 contribution. And they appreciate the interviews and the local news that we do. Thank you. And Desi Saludas from Plant City has just made a $111 contribution. Desi, thank you. And thanks, he says, to WMNF for honest news and respectful dialogue. So, Sean, we've got this challenge. We need 10 people donating $100, and we'll get an extra $1,000 from two generous people, one in Venice and one in St. Petersburg. Our phone number is 813-238-8001. We're going to go back and hear investigative reporter Robert Evans talk about the activities of the far right in Portland. And just remember that just last week, 13 people were arrested. The militia types were arrested in Michigan because they were planning to kidnap the governor and launch an attack on the state capitol. This is getting really serious out there. We want to be here for you. Let's hope it doesn't get worse than it is right now, but we want to be here for you. So please call us up, make that contribution. Sean, we haven't had a donation in the last 3 minutes, so I'm a little bit worried.
Well, I think that people are going to call in right now because this type of interview that you're airing right now is so valuable to us. We need this kind of information, as you were saying. I have to say, I'm really glad that we don't have these open carry protests where anyone can just waltz into the state capitals or into Tampa City Hall or whatever with guns and just that's okay. There was a gun drawn in a protest a couple of weeks ago in St. Petersburg, and then maybe St. Pete police didn't act very quickly at the time, but after the fact they said they should have. So thankfully this isn't something that right now in Central Florida we have to be super concerned about, although it does seem to be simmering underneath where the activists are following around different protesters, know them by name, and are calling them out, threatening violence. And so this is really something kind of unprecedented. I don't think we've seen this level of violence, threatened or actual violence, in decades in the United States, because these right-wing armed groups are really, really itching, it seems, for violence. And we need to know all of the facts. And that's what WMNF is bringing to you through interviews with Robert Evans. Rob does great interviews every morning on radioactivity. And if you support that, we do need to hear from you. Can you make your $100 donation right now by donating at WMNF.org or by calling 813-238-8001. Keep this kind of journalism alive. Keep this type of information flowing in the Tampa Bay area. We need to know as much as we can in these troubled times, and WMNF hopefully is a source that you trust and that you will support with your financial donation.
Sean, we're going to go back to the interview. We could lose the $1,000 because we're not getting those 10 $100 contributions we need to get the match, we're going to play the interview, and thank you to everybody who's listening, and thank you if you've already made a contribution to WMNF. We are really, when you hear the names of people thanked on MNF, these are the people that are keeping the radio station on the air, and we thank them very much. But we haven't had a phone call here now in 5 minutes. We need at least one phone call at 813-238-8001. Make a contribution to help us stay on the air. You can also go online at WMNF.org. But if you believe that there should be at least one radio station talking about these ultra important issues and giving you facts about these issues and giving you long form interviews, if you believe that there should be one radio station like this in the entire Tampa Bay area, nobody in the Tampa Bay area has interviewed Robert Evans about this topic, and it is one of the most important topics out there. Please make that contribution now. We can't do it without you. We're still about, right now, for this hour, we're about 16 calls short. 813-238-8001. We haven't gotten a call in 6 minutes, but let's go back to the interview with Robert Evans.
There are often clear signs. In fact, the Tree of Life synagogue shooter, an anti-fascist researcher I know, had been receiving death threats from that fellow for months before he carried out his attack. And, you know, prior to Tree of Life, I don't think a lot of that was taken seriously by law enforcement. I know a lot of folks, a lot of researchers and journalists who have gone to law enforcement with death threats, and they get taken more seriously now. But there was a prior to Tree of Life, if you had threats that were primarily online, they weren't taken seriously at all. So I think we do owe to these folks who have been doing this online research for years, who have been studying these organizations, we all kind of do owe a debt of gratitude, because when it was not taken seriously by people whose job it is to protect us, these folks knew that this was still a threat and took it seriously and did the documentation. And I do think we have to be grateful for that.
Some of the discussions that that these people on the far right, the Patriot Coalition of Oregon, that you uncovered, some of the discussions are pretty frightening. There's one in which a user named Roger Charlie Bravo posted on September 15th, what we're going to do is not random. Patriots around the country are currently organizing and preparing. We know D-Day is coming after November. What does that mean? How did you interpret that?
I interpret that kind of within the spectrum of a number of things I've heard from different right-wing groups, which is that among members of the far right, the insurgent right, as we call them. So obviously, you know, most people who are conservative, have right-wing views, are members of a peaceful general society just like the rest of us. But there is a sizable and growing far-right insurgent movement that seeks to do violence against its political enemies. And many of them are convinced that a civil war is coming after the election in November, that either Trump will lose, but it won't be legitimate, or you know, that something, some of them believe that it'll start on the left, certainly, and there's people on the left who think or are worried about a civil war. But on the right, on the far right, the level of preparation for this is pretty extensive. You know, you had, after Jay Danielson, who was the member of Patriot Prayer who was shot to death in Portland, after he was shot by a person who was, you know, affiliated with a BLM protest group and had declared himself Antifa, Stuart Rhodes, the head of the Oath Keepers, which is maybe the largest nationwide militia network in the United States, declared it the start of a civil war. Like, so that you can find, it's not, you don't have to have leaked communications to see people talking about this sort of stuff. Now, does that mean we're going to have a civil war? No, of course not necessarily. But the fact that you do have thousands and thousands of heavily armed people talking about their desire to participate in one should concern us all. It is a serious thing that needs to be dealt with seriously, because that, again, doesn't guarantee that there will be some sort of large civil conflict in the country, but certainly one of the precursors for a large-scale civil conflict is a bunch of heavily armed people who want to do violence to their political enemies. And we do have that. And it's very organized on the far right. You know, from what I'm seeing, it's much smaller on the far left, and also not nearly as well armed, and not nearly as active in actually preparing. Whereas you have a very large insurgent far right movement that's, you know, try to buy ammunition online right now. It's pretty much impossible, and there's a reason for that.
We have people I've talked with. Talked and interviewed people who say, look, Antifa is just like these far-right groups, both present a danger to our society. You say that the right is more heavily armed than is the left. I don't know if anybody's done a study of it, but the people that I know who are on the left are pretty much nonviolent. And when you hear people equating Antifa with these right-wing groups like the Patriot Coalition or the Oath Keepers or any number, I mean, there's a bunch of them out there. What are your thoughts, having covered both?
I'll say, you know, I reported from the left-wing protests, the BLM protests in Portland for months, you know, most of the first 80 days and or 80 nights of it. And there were no serious injuries
let's see, for the first like 60, 70 days it took for there to be any kind of significant injury caused by a protester. And it was one guy got kicked in the head because he had been driving like erratically. People thought he was trying to like hit them with his car. And there had been a number of successful car attacks. Like it was a horrible thing that was done. And the person who kicked the guy was put in jail. Like it turned himself in and is in jail awaiting sentencing. It took 60 or 70 days for that. And that was not the most serious injury of the protest. All of the most serious injuries were caused by police or federal agents. You know, federal agents shot a young man, Donovan LaBella, in the skull with a rubber round because he was holding a boombox over his head. There's video of the whole thing, and it completely shattered his skull. He's been in and out of surgery ever since. So it took, with these quote, issues people have, is that anti-fascist demonstrators embrace force as potentially a valid thing to use in fighting back against fascist violence, as they call it. And usually what that means is property destruction. If you actually look at internal documents, the FBI, that have been leaked from the FBI, that have been leaked from DHS, the vast majority of them will say that when we think about left-wing violence and left-wing, you know, criminal action, it's generally property destruction. And there was no one was killed in the streets of Portland until there were multiple weeks of right-wing demonstrations that ended in gunfire first. The night that Jay Danielson was killed was the night of the giant Trump truck rally, which happened the weekend after the giant street fight on the 22nd, and 2 weeks after another right-wing rally where a right-wing demonstrator fired into a crowd with a 9mm handgun, thankfully not hitting people. And on the night he was killed, Jay Danielson and the guy he was with both had mace and batons in their hands, and both had handguns. Jay had like 76 rounds on his body. And the left-wing demonstrator who shot him, it may have been a political killing. It's certainly possible. We do not have, you know, and we will never really have confirmation, because that fellow was killed by federally deputized police like a week or so later. But early reports from people who were there say that one of the folks on Danielson's side had a knife. Like, I don't know if that guy was scared for his life or what, but kind of the fact of the matter is that these protests in Portland went on for 80 some nights and didn't end in a death until there started being these large and heavily armed right-wing counter protests. Because, you know, you can say what you will about the BLM demonstrations in Portland. They certainly have broken a ton of laws, but the vast majority of the crimes they've committed have been property crimes. Virtually all of the crimes committed have been, like, damage to police property. People would break the doors of police stations. They would, you know, light trash can fires in front of them and stuff like that. Not things that seriously were injurious to human life. And they weren't really bringing a lot of weapons out, like firearms and stuff. That didn't start to happen until there were these kind of dueling right-wing demonstrations. So when I think about the difference in violence between the two, I think left-wing demonstrators, anti-fascist demonstrators, you know, Antifa, if you want to call them that, are certainly much more comfortable committing crimes. But the vast majority of those crimes tend to be nonviolent crimes, which is why in recent years you've seen more than 300 murders by right-wing extremists, and you've seen arguably one killing that can be connected to somebody who has actually taken part in anti-fascist action. You know, it's just the actual rate of violence against human beings, of deadly violence against human beings. It's not even comparable. You know, again, hundreds and hundreds of deaths due to white supremacist extremists in the United States, and maybe, very arguably, one that you can attribute to an anti-fascist demonstrator.
In these chat logs, did the right-wing Patriot Coalition of Oregon, did it say that the press and lawyers groups like the ACLU were the enemy to be targeted? What did they say about the press and the ACLU and the National Lawyers Guild?
Well, one of the members of this group is a convicted felon named David Willis. Willis can't own firearms, but he does own an AR-15-style paintball gun that he loads with rubber rounds and shoots into crowds. And Willis was urging his fellow protesters that the people to target are the ACLU and the National Lawyers Guild, because they tend to film these fights, and that thus they're filming, you know, a lot of illegal assaults being committed by right-wing demonstrators. And so they should be harmed. You know, that's what he was talking about. Is he was talking about essentially going after press, and there was actually even discussion of dressing up in black bloc to appear to be anti-fascist and assaulting press in the streets so that it would get blamed on Antifa. There's discussion about both of those things, and there were certainly a lot of assaults on press. David Willis shot at press with his rubber round loaded paintball gun. He hit people that I know.
Our guest is Robert Evans, and he's been investigating right-wing groups on the West Coast, and this is WMNF in Tampa. So, Robert, why Portland? Why has the right targeted your city for these kind of confrontations?
You know, there's a number of reasons, and some of this goes back to Oregon's history. So Oregon has arguably, certainly one of the most, and arguably the most racist history of any state in the Union, because it's the only state in the United States that was founded as a whites-only state. And in fact, the first Supreme Court justice that Oregon had, a guy named Burnett, had a law that made it illegal for black people to stay in Oregon without getting whipped. And again, this was after the Civil War. White supremacy has a long history here. And Oregon currently has more militia groups per capita than any other state. There is an enormous amount of neo-Nazi activism, not just in Oregon, but in the whole Pacific Northwest. There's an idea among neo-Nazis that came up in the 90s called the Northwest Imperative, which is that because the Pacific Northwest is the whitest part of the United States, everyone who is essentially a Nazi or whatever should move there in preparation for a societal breakdown so that it can become a new whites-only homeland. So Oregon has been dealing with that for a while. The fact that there's a lot more organized Nazis and other kinds of you know, white supremacist extremists within the state. And so there have been clashes between left-wing anti-racist groups and these kind of racist far-right groups for a very long time. I mean, you can go back into the 80s and find examples of that. In fact, you know, Idaho is also kind of a hotbed of this stuff. So Portland has a long history with this. And in fact, Portland's local Antifa organization, Rose City Antifa, is the oldest Antifa organization within the United States. And they formed in the early 2000s because a neo-Nazi music festival was trying to come to Portland. The Hammerskin Nation was trying to do a music festival in Portland, and they successfully shut it down because they thought it would be of significant danger to non-white residents of Portland, which they had reason to believe because there have been murders committed in Portland by members of white supremacist organizations. Kind of the most famous was in the 1990s, a young Ethiopian immigrant named Mulugeta Sarah was murdered by members of the White Aryan Resistance, which is a California-based neo-Nazi organization run by a fellow named Tom Metzger. So all of this is a big part of the background of why Portland has become kind of the center of clashes. Another aspect of it is just that Portland is a very good example of something that is a trend nationwide, which is that cities tend to be more liberal and left-leaning, and rural areas tend to be more conservative and right-leaning. And in Portland, the divide is, or in Oregon, the divide is particularly extreme. Portland and Eugene are two of the furthest left-leaning cities in the entire country. But the Oregon countryside, rural Oregon, is extremely conservative. And so in addition to this history of like actual kind of confrontations between anti-racists and white supremacists, you also have the fact that there's a very real divide between urban and rural in this state. And, you know, rural conservatives have good reason to be frustrated with a lot of the decisions being made by sort of the left-wing majority that lives in the cities, because people who live in Portland and Eugene and, you know, the other cities in Oregon don't really have a conception of kind of the reality of life for people who, you know, work on a farm somewhere in Josephine County. But they get to make the laws for the whole state because of the majority. And of course, that breeds very reasonable frustration from people. So Oregon is kind of this perfect storm. And because of the way that just media and social media in particular works nowadays, when these clashes started up again in the street, video from these clashes, riot porn is the term that people use sometimes, started going very viral. And in addition to actual like journalists posting footage from these riots, a kind of a community of, I would call them grifters, set up, who would edit the fight to be, to look worse than they were and to look more one-sided than they were, and would post them up on a number of like far right leaning sites to try to get people angry. And it sort of, in the years that President Trump has been in office, Portland has developed among the far right into a city where you can go to get into fights and to get experience having street fights, right? Mm-hmm. If you're a right wing demonstrator. So yeah, there's a lot going on.
Well, so
you ask the question, why Portland? But that's my short answer.
And one thing that really riled up people in the Oregon countryside is that they believe that Antifa was setting the fires that had Oregon on fire a few weeks ago, the wildfires.
Yeah, that led to, because there's no truth to it whatsoever, and that led to one of the oddest moments of this entire summer, which was the FBI, local law enforcement, and local anti-fascist collectives all on Twitter saying the same thing, which was, there's no evidence that this is being done by, like, left-wing demonstrators, like, please stop spreading this around, because it became a real problem. People, the level of, and again, I think social media is to blame for this, the level of paranoia that exists in the rural countryside here about left-wing demonstrators, Antifa, is so extreme that, number one, people were carrying out armed checkpoints. People were threatening each other with firearms. It's kind of a miracle no one got killed. I have friends who were pressed that were threatened with an AR-15 by people doing like a street patrol because they were out reporting on the fires. And you also had actual like emergency lines, police emergency lines being flooded, just completely overwhelmed with calls about, you know, someone would see someone in their yard doing something and would assume that it was Antifa and would call, you know, the FBI or whoever about it. And some of what would happen was like people would be trying to create like fire breaks on their own property by doing controlled burns, and people would mistake that for arson. And of course, there's also the fact that this is extremely well documented. You look at Texas's massive wildfires, you look at California's wildfires, or the ones in Oregon, there are always, or what happened in Australia earlier this year, there are always arsonists who come out during these times and will set some fires. And most of them tend to be caught pretty much immediately because they're not well, you know, they're not rationally trying to create a fire for any specific purpose. They're ill people. And this is the thing, again, that happens worldwide when there's massive wildfires, is that people who are arsonists for whatever reason come out and may start some fires. But it doesn't tend to contribute to the actual fire systems that create the problem, because the issues that cause these massive sweeping fires are much more significant than that. You know, it's a matter of climate change. It's a matter of the way the winds are blowing. You know, there's a lot of people who start fires in Southern California, and when the winds are right, nothing happens. But when those Santa Ana winds are blowing in the wrong direction, it can become a problem. You had all of this kind of going on with this massive level of media paranoia about Antifa, and it just caused this horror storm. And it was exacerbated by the fact, I don't know if you've ever been stuck in the middle of a wildfire, but the air in Northern Oregon was the worst in the world during that period. And it messed with everybody's head. Everybody was anxious.
That's an interview I did last week with Robert Evans, an investigative reporter. He works for Bellingcat.com, and we've been talking about how he found leaked chat logs showing Portland area right-wing activists planning and training for violence, sourcing arms and ammunition, even suggesting political assassinations ahead of a series of contentious rallies in Portland, Oregon. And that whole interview is on our website. We haven't heard the end of it yet, and we may not be able to play it. We're raising money here at WMNF, trying to raise a lot of money over 2 days. The fund drive ends tomorrow. We're just doing two-day fund drives now. And Sean Kinnan is on the phone. I'm Rob Lori. And we have a challenge. We have a possible $1,000 will be given to WMNF from two generous listeners, one in St. Petersburg and one in Venice, if we can get 10 people donating $100. And we are down to the last 5 or 6 minutes of this radioactivity program, the last radioactivity program of the fund drive. And Sean, we've got some good news. We are just we've received 7 $100 donations, so we're just three $100 donations away from reaching the goal. So that is really good. People can make a contribution online at WMNF.org. If you're listening on the phone app, there's a little button for the tip jar. Use that to make your contribution. But Linda Bragg, thank you from Newport Richey, made a $100 contribution. Very nice. Thanks to Anonymous, who in Sarasota made a $100 contribution. Pamela Claussen made a $100 contribution. Thank you, Pamela. And says, new to the area from Seattle, glad to find WMNF. All right, that's great. I love Seattle. And thanks to Brooke Martin from Dade City, just made a $100 contribution. 813-238-8001. And Brooke says that WMNF is the crown jewel of the Tampa Bay area, and thanks to all the station volunteers and staff for their work, and that's for the match. So, Sean, we're just I haven't read all the contributions, but we are just three donations away, three $100 contributions away from getting an extra $1,000 to help this fund drive.
So if you're out there and you have the ability to donate $100 to your community radio station, that will help us to meet the match. We could get an extra $1,000 if three of you can do that. So if you're in that position, please give us a call right now, 813-238-8001, or make a secure donation on WMNF.org to support the interviews that Rob brings you on Radioactivity. This is such an important topic, and I'm really glad that Rob is playing this interview because we're all learning a lot about what we know about right-wing militias and their idea that violence is coming in this country, and we really need to be aware of it and know as much as we possibly can. So Rob is interviewing an expert, and if you can support that work with your donation, call us at 813-238-8001. A $100 donation would really help us out right now. Can you make that donation?
And the other donations that we received during the interview, Anonymous in Bradenton just made a $35 contribution, and Juna Brown just made a $100 contribution, and Juna is in Lakeland, says MNF is the most honest source of real news. It's so important now. Sean, we are just three $100 donations from reaching that goal. Thanks to Larry King in Venice, just made a $100 donation, and he says, a trillion great talents at all hours, wisdom and love, and thank you very much, Larry King, for that nice contribution. Sean, we are down to the last 2 minutes or 3 minutes of Radioactivity. We want to reach that goal. We want to get that $1,000 match, and we just need three people to donate $100 or more, and we'll get an extra $1,000 from two generous listeners, one in St. Petersburg and one in Venice. And that one in Venice is Kevin Marshall. Kevin, thank you very much for that nice contribution. 813-238-8001. You can also make your contribution on our website, WMNF.org. Sean, we are not there yet, though. I can't believe it. We're down to the last 2 minutes. This is the last 2 minutes that Radioactivity will be asking for money during this drive. We just need three good people to go to their phone right now, 813-238-8001.
And here's the best way, the easiest way, perhaps, to help us to meet that match. You can join the Circle of Friends at $10 a month. That's our sustaining membership. You'll fill out the paperwork, and we'll take $10 a month either out of your checking account or out of your credit card. You decide. And that $10 a month will help us to meet that match. If you can join the Circle of Friends at $10 a month, give our phone answerers a call, 813-238-8001. You could also choose that option when you donate online, either on the WMNF app or on WMNF.org.
Sean, I see two lines lit, so I think we just need one more phone call, and we'll get that match, that all-important match. We've got one more hour. We've got the Midpoint program coming up, and Shelley and Janet have interviews with several local election supervisors, and they're going to answer your questions via email. Every question you ever had about elections will be answered in the next hour on Midpoint, so stick around for that. But we need just one more donation to get that $1,000 match during this hour, 813-238-8001, or make your contribution online at WMNF.org, WMNF.org, and that's our secure website. Sean, we're not there. We have about 45 seconds to go.
Wow, you could be the last-minute hero if you call in right now to support Radioactivity. You could be the person that puts us over the top with this matching donation. With your $100 contribution, we can get an extra $1,000. Wouldn't that make you feel good? Wouldn't that make you so proud of having a community radio station that you can support, that you're a part of, that you're part owner of? 813-238-8001 or WMNF.org.
And thanks, everybody, for listening, and thanks for making MNF a success, especially if you've contributed in the last year. You've helped keep one of the most one of the best community radio stations in the country on the air. This is WMNF in Tampa. We're not there yet, but we're going to have to take a break for news, and then stay tuned for Midpoint. Here's the news.